Recorded Books and RB Digital present The Road Back by Eric Maria Remarque. Narrated by Graham Halstead. Prologue. What is still left of No. 2 Platoon is quartered in a stretch of battered trench behind the line, and most of them are dozing. Funny sort of shell, says Yup suddenly.
What do you mean?
Asks Ferdinand Cozzola, sitting up. Use your ears, answers Yup. Cozzola puts a hand to his ear and listens. We also listen into the darkness, but there is nothing audible beyond the dull rumble of gunfire and the high piping of the shells. From the right sounds the rattle of machine guns, and now and then a cry. But all these we have known some years now. There is nothing new in that to make a new song about. Cozzola looks at Yup suspiciously.
It's stopped now, of course, says Yup by way of defending himself.
Cozzola looks him over once more, appraisingly. Yup remains unperturbed, and he turns away, muttering,
It's the rumble in your own hungry guts. That's all your shells are. Best thing you can do is get an eye full of sleep.
He knocks up a sort of earthen headrest and stretches out, disposing himself cautiously so that his boots shall not slip down into the water.
God, there's the missus and a bed for two at home, he murmurs, his eyes already closed.
Somebody else is in it by now, I dare say, retorts Yup out of his corner. Cozzola opens one eye and gives him a hard look. For a moment, it seems as if he means to get up again.
Don't you be too funny, you poor fish.
And he is snoring already. Yup signs to me to crawl over to him. I step across Adolf Bethke's legs and sit down beside him. With a sidelong glance at the snoring figure, he says sourly, The likes of that don't even know what education is. Yup was a clerk in a solicitor's office before the war, and though he has been soldiering 3 years now, he still feels himself superior and, in most curious wise, sets great store on education out here at the front. What that means exactly he does not know himself, of course, but more than all else that he ever heard tell of in the days gone by, the word education has stayed with him, and to that he clings, as if it were a plank in the sea that he shall not go under. Everybody has something of the sort, this one a wife, another his business, a third his boots, Valentin Laher his schnapps, and Tjaden the hope of tasting broad beans and bacon once more. On the other hand, nothing so irritates Cozzola as that very word, education. He always connects it some way or another with the idea of high collars, and for him that is enough. Even now it has its effect. Without interrupting his sleep,
Bloody pen-pusher, says he gruffly.
Yup shakes his head, resigned and pitying. We sit on in silence a while, side by side, to warm ourselves. The night is wet and cold. Clouds are driving overhead, and it rains off and on. Then we take up the waterproof on which we are sitting, and while the rain lasts, hang it over our heads. Along the skyline are the flashes of gunfire. One feels that over there must be a region a little less cold. It looks so cozy. Like gaily colored and silver flowers, the flares spring up above the lightning flashes of the artillery. Big and red, the moon swims in the wet air above the ruins of a farm.
Think we're going home, whispers Yup.
I shrug my shoulders.
The rumor is,
Yup sighs aloud.
A warm room and a sofa, and going out of nights. Can you picture it still?
I tried on my civvies last time I was on leave, I say meditatively.
but they're ever so much too small for me now. I'll have to get new things. How marvelous that all sounds here. Civvies, a sofa, the evening. But it brings strange thoughts, like black coffee, when sometimes it tastes too much of the tin and rust of the Dixie, and one coughs it up again, hot and choking. Yup is picking his nose absently. Shop windows and cafes and women. Oh, boy.
Ah, man, you just be thankful you're back here out of the muck for a bit,
say I, and blow into my frozen hands. That's true. Yup draws the waterproof up over his thin, bent shoulders. What'll you do when you get out of this? I laugh. I'll have to go back to school again, I suppose. Willie and Albert and I, and even Ludwig over there, too, I say, pointing back to where someone is lying before a dugout entrance under two greatcoats. Good Lord, but you won't do that, surely, exclaims Yup. I don't know. Probably have to, I reply, and feel furious without knowing why. There is a movement under the greatcoats. A pale, thin face lifts up and groans softly. It is my schoolmate, Lieutenant Ludwig Breyer, our platoon commander. He has had diarrhea for weeks. It is dysentery, of course, but he does not want to go back into hospital. He would sooner stay here with us, for we are all waiting now in hopes of peace. Then we shall be able to take him back with us at once. The hospitals are all full to overflowing. No one is properly looked after there, and once a man lies down on it, he is only so much nearer to being dead. Men die all around one. It gets on a fellow's nerves, alone there among it all, and before he knows where he has made another himself. Max Weil, our stretcher-bearer, has given Breyer a sort of fluid plaster to eat so as to cement up his bowels and stay him for a bit. But even so, he has his trousers down 20 and 30 times a day. And now he must go again. I assist him around the corner and he squats down. Yup signs to me.
Listen, there it is again.
What?
The shells I was talking about before.
Kozola stirs and yawns. He gets up, significantly examines his great fist. He looks askance at Yup and says,
Well, my boy, if you're trying to pull our leg again, you'll soon be sending your bones home in a turnip sack.
We listen. The hiss and whistle of the invisible arching shells is interrupted by a queer, hoarse, long-drawn sound, so strange and new that my flesh creeps up.
Gas shells!
Shouts Willie, springing up. Now we are all awake and listening intently. Vessling points into the air.
There they are! Wild geese!
Moving darkly against the drab gray of the clouds is a streak, a wedge, its point steering towards the moon. It cuts across its red disk. The black shadows are plainly visible, an angle of many wings, a column of squalling, strange, wild cries that loses itself in the distance.
Off they go, growls Willie. Damn it all. If only we could pull out like that. Two wings and away.
Heinrich Vessling follows the geese with his eyes.
Now for winter, says he slowly.
Vessling is a farmer and understands these things.
Breyer, weak and wretched, leans against the parados and murmurs,
First time I ever saw that.
But Kozola has brightened up at once. He gets Vessling to explain the matter to him quickly once more, asking particularly whether wild geese are as fat as tame ones.
More or less, says Vessling.
My poor belly, exclaims Kozola, his jaws working with excitement. And 15, 20 maybe, good roast dinners flying about there in the air.
Again, the whir of wings straight above us. Again, the hoarse, throaty cry swooping down into our hearts like a hawk. The lapping pulse of their wings, the urgent cries, gusts of the rising wind all united in one passionate, swift sense of freedom and life. A shot rings out. Kozola lowers his rifle and peers hungrily into the sky. He has fired into the middle of the flight. Beside him stands Tiadam, ready, like a retriever, to dash out should a goose fall. But the flight passes on intact.
Hard luck, says Baitke. That might have been the first sensible shot in this whole lousy war.
Gozola throws down his rifle in disgust.
If only a man had some shot cartridges.
He settles back into gloom, conjuring all the things that might have been. And as he sits, he chews unconsciously. Yes, says Yup, observing him. With applesauce and baked potatoes, what?
Kozola looks at him poisonously. You shut up, you pen pusher.
You should have joined the Air Force, grins Yup. Then you might have gone after them with a butterfly net.
Arseholes, answers Kozola finally, and settles down to sleep once more.
And that is best. The rain becomes heavier. We sit back to back and drape our waterproof sheets over us. Like dark mounds of earth, we squat there in our little bit of trench. Earth, uniform, and a little life underneath. A harsh whispering wakes me.
Forward, forward.
Why, what's the matter?
I ask, drunken with sleep.
We've to go up the line, growls Kozola, assembling his things.
But we've only just come here, I say, mystified.
Such damned rot, I hear Vessling cursing. The bloody war's over, isn't it? Up! Forward!
It is Hale himself, our company commander, driving us out. He is running impatiently down the trench. Ludwig Breyer is already on his feet.
There's nothing for it.
We've got to go, says he resignedly, taking a few hand grenades. Adolf Baitke looks at him.
You should stay here, Ludwig. You can't go up with your dysentery.
Breyer shakes his head. The scraping sound of belts being tightened, a clatter of rifles, the sickly smell of death suddenly rising up again out of the earth. And we had hoped at last to have escaped it forever. The thought of peace had sprung up before us like a rocket, and though indeed we did not yet believe or understand it, the bare hope had sufficed to change us more in the few minutes it took for the rumor to circulate than anything in 20 months before. Till now, the years of war had succeeded each other, year laid upon year, one year of hopelessness treading fast upon another. And when a man reckoned the time, his amazement was almost as great to discover it had been so long as that it had been only so long. But now that it has become known that peace may come any day, every hour has gained in weight 1,000-fold. Every minute under fire seems harder and longer almost than the whole time before. The wind meows around the remains of the breastworks, and clouds draw swiftly over the moon, light constantly alternating with shadow. We march close, one behind another, a group of shadows, a sorry spectacle. Number 2 platoon shot to a mere handful of men.
The whole company has scarce the strength of a normal platoon.
But this remnant is choice, thoroughly sifted. We have even 3 old-timers still from 14. Baitke, Vessling, and Kozola, who know everything and often speak of the first months as though that were away back in the olden days of the gods and the heroes. Each man seeks out a corner, a hole for himself in the new position. There is nothing much doing. Flares, machine guns, rats. With a well-aimed kick, Vili tosses one up and slices it in two in midair with one cut from a spade. A few scattered shots fall. From the left sound distantly the explosion of hand grenades.
"Let's hope it stays quiet here," says Vesling. "To get it in the neck now,"
Vili shakes his head.
"When a man's luck is out, he'll break his finger just picking his nose,"
growls Valentin. Ludwig lies down on his waterproof sheet. He could, as a matter of fact, have stayed behind. Vile gives him a couple of tabloids, and Valentin tries to persuade him to have a nip of schnapps. Lederhose starts to tell some smutty yarn, but no one listens. We lie around, and the time creeps on. I start suddenly and lift my head. Baitka, too, I see, is sitting up. Even Tjaden is on the alert. The year-old instinct has reported something. None yet knows what, but certainly something strange is afoot. We raise our heads gingerly and listen, our eyes narrow to slits to penetrate the darkness. Everyone is awake. Every sense is strained to the uttermost. Every muscle ready to receive the unknown, oncoming thing that can mean only danger. The hand grenades scrape over the ground as Vili, our best bomb thrower, worms himself forward. We lie close pressed to the ground, like cats. Beside me, I discover Ludwig Breyer. There is nothing of sickness in his tense features now. His is the same cold, deathly expression as everyone's here, the front line face. A fierce tension has frozen it. So extraordinary is the impression that our subconsciousness has imparted to us long before our senses are able to identify it. The fog moves and lifts, and suddenly I know what it is that has thrown us all into such a state of alarm. It has merely become still. Absolutely still. Not a machine gun, not a shot, not an explosion, no shriek of shells, nothing, absolutely nothing, no shot, no cry. It is simply still, utterly still. We look at one another. We cannot understand it. It is the first time it has been so quiet since we have been at the front. We sniff the air and try to figure what it can mean. Is gas creeping over? But the wind is not favorable. It would drive it off. Is an attack coming? But the very silence would have betrayed it already. What is it then? The bomb in my hand is moist. I am sweating so with excitement. One feels as if the nerves must snap. 5 minutes. 10 minutes. "A quarter of an hour now," calls Laher. His voice sounds hollow in the fog as from a grave. Still nothing happens. No attack. No sudden, dark looming, springing shadows. Hands relax and clench again tighter. This is not to be borne. We are so accustomed to the noise of the front that now, when the weight of it suddenly lifts from us, we feel as if we must burst, shoot upward like balloons.
"Why," says Vili suddenly, "it is peace."
It falls like a bomb. Faces relax. Movements become aimless and uncertain. Peace. We look at one another, incredulous. Peace? I let my hand grenades drop. Peace. Ludwig lies down slowly on his waterproof again. Peace. In Baitke's eyes is an expression as if his whole face would break in pieces.
Peace.
Vessling stands motionless as a tree, and when he turns his back on it and faces us, he looks as if he meant to keep straight on home. All at once, in the whirl of our excitement we had hardly observed it, the silence is at an end. Once more, dully menacing, comes the noise of gunfire, and already from afar, like the bill of a woodpecker, sounds the knock-knocking of a machine gun. We grow calm and are almost glad to hear again the familiar, trusty noises of death. It has been quiet all day. At night we have to retire a little, as so often before. But the fellows over yonder do not simply follow us. They attack. Before we are ready, heavy shelling comes over, and behind us the red fountains roar upward into the gloom. For the moment it is still quiet where we are. Vili and Tjaden light on a tin of meat and polish it off on the spot. The rest just lie there and wait. The many months have consumed them. So long as they cannot defend themselves, they are almost indifferent. Hale, our company commander, crawls up.
"Have you everything?" he asks through the din. "Too little ammunition," shouts Baitke.
Hale gives a shrug and passes Baitke a cigarette over his shoulder. Without looking around, Baitke nods.
"Have to make good with what you have," shouts
Hale and springs into the next shell hole. He knows they will make good, right enough. Any of these old hands would make as good a company commander as himself. It grows dark. The fire catches us. There is practically no cover. With hands and spades, we scoop holes for our heads in the crater, and so we lie, pressed close to the ground, Albert and Baitke beside me. A shell lands not 20 yards from us. As the beast comes on screaming, we open wide our mouths to save our eardrums. Even so, we are half deafened, and our eyes filled with dirt and muck, and in our noses the foul stench of powder and sulfur. It rains metal. Somebody has stopped one, for along with a smoking shell fragment, there lands in our crater by Baitke's head a severed hand. Hale bounds into our shell hole. In the flashes of the explosions, his face shows white as chalk with fury.
"Brant," he gasps. "Direct hit. Clean gone."
It crashes down once more. It pelts, roars, rains down mud and steel. The air thunders. The earth groans. The curtain of fire lifts again, slides back. At the same instant, men arise, seared black out of the earth, bombs in their hands, watching, ready.
"Slowly back," shouts Hale.
The attack lies on our left front. There is a fight for a machine gun post in a shell hole. The machine gun is barking. The flashes of hand grenades leap convulsively. Suddenly, the gun is silent. A stoppage. Immediately, the post is outflanked. A couple of minutes, and it must be taken. Hale sees it.
"Damn!"
He goes over the parapet.
"Forward!"
Ammunition is tossed up, and we go up after it. Soon, Vili, Baitke, and Hale are lying within throwing distance, and throw. Hale jumps up again. He is stark mad at such moments, a perfect fiend. But it succeeds. The fellows in the shell hole take new heart. The machine gun comes again into action. Contact is made, and together we make a dash for the concrete pillbox behind us. It has all happened so quickly that the Tommies have not even realized that the post has been evacuated. Flashes continue to burst in the abandoned crater. It grows quieter. I am anxious about Ludwig, but he is there. Then Baitke crawls in.
"Vessling?" What's Vessling doing? Where's Vessling?
The cry goes up suddenly above the dull rumble of the long-range guns.
Vessling! Vessling!
Hale appears.
What is it?
Vessling's missing.
Todden had been beside him when the word came to retire. After that, he had not seen him again.
Where?
Asks Cazola. Todden points.
Damn.
Cazola looks at Baitka. Baitka at Cazola. Each knows that this is perhaps our last fight. They do not hesitate.
Right for me,
growls Baitka.
Come on, grunts Cazola.
They vanish into the darkness. Hale goes out after them. Ludwig puts all in readiness to charge immediately should the three be attacked. At first, all remains quiet. Then suddenly there are flashes of bombs. Revolver shots crack between. We go forward immediately, Ludwig leading. Then the sweating faces of Baitka and Cazola reappear, lugging someone behind them in a waterproof.
Hale?
It is Vessling who groans. And Hale, holding them off, it was he that fired. He is back again almost immediately.
Got the whole bunch in the shell hole, he shouts. And then two with a revolver.
He stares down at Vessling.
Well, how is it?
But Vessling does not answer. His belly lies open like a butcher's stall. One cannot see how deep the wounds go. We bandage them as well as we can. Vessling is groaning for water, but he gets none. Stomach wounds may not drink. Then he begs for blankets. He is freezing. He has lost so much blood. A runner brings the order to retire still farther. We take Vessling with us in a waterproof sheet, through which is passed a rifle for carrying until we can find a stretcher. One behind the other, we grope our way cautiously. It grows gradually light, silver mist in the low bushes. We are leaving the fighting zone. Already we imagine it over when a bullet comes swishing up softly and strikes. Ludwig silently rolls up his sleeve. He has stopped one in the arm. Vial bandages him. We go back and back. The air is mild as wine. This is no November. It is more like March, and the sky is pale blue and clear. In the pools along the road, the sun lies mirrored. We pass down an avenue of poplars. The trees stand on either side of the road, tall and almost unscathed, except that here and there one is missing. This region lay formerly well behind the lines, and has not been so devastated as those miles before it, that, day by day, yard by yard, we have yielded. The sun glints on the brown waterproof, and as we go along the yellow avenue, leaves keep floating, sailing down upon it. A few fall inside it. At the dressing station, everywhere is full. Many of the wounded are lying outside, before the door. For the time being, we put Vessling there, too. A number of fellows with arm wounds and white bandages are lining up to march out. The hospital is to be relieved. A doctor is running about, examining the newcomers. He orders one chap, whose leg is hanging loose and bent the wrong way at the knee joint, to be taken in at once. Vessling is merely bandaged and remains outside. He rouses from his stupor and looks anxiously after the doctor.
What is he going away for?
He'll be back in a minute, I tell him.
But I must go in. I must be operated on.
He becomes suddenly terribly excited and feels for the bandage.
That must be stitched up straight away.
We try to calm him. He is quite green and sweating with fear.
Adolf, run after him. He must come.
Bethke hesitates a moment. But under Vesling's eye, there is nothing else for it, though he knows it will be to no purpose. I see him speak with the doctor. Vesling follows him as far as he can with his eyes. He looks terrible as he struggles to turn his head. Returning, Bethke makes a detour so that Vesling shall not be able to get a sight of him. He shakes his head, makes the figure one with his finger, and with his mouth shapes inaudibly, 1 hour. We put on cheerful faces, but who can deceive a dying peasant? While Bethke is yet telling him that he is to be operated on later, but the wounds must heal a little first, Vesling already knows all. He is silent a moment, then he cries aloud,
"Yes, you stand there and are whole, and are going home, and I, 4 years and now this, 4 years, and then this."
"You're going into the hospital all right, Heinrich," says Bethke, comforting him. But he would not listen.
"Let be."
Thereafter, he does not say much, nor does he want to be carried in, but to stay outside. The hospital is on a gentle slope, whence one can see far out along the avenue down which we have come. It is all gay and golden. The earth lies there, still and smooth and secure. Even fields are to be seen, little brown, tilled strips, right close by the hospital. And when the wind blows away the stench of blood and of gangrene, one can smell the pungent plowed earth. The distance is blue and everywhere peaceful, for from here the view is away from the front. Vesling is still. He is observing everything most narrowly. His eyes are clear and alert. He is a farmer and at home with the country. He understands it better and otherwise than we. He knows that he must leave it now. So he will miss nothing, nor does he take his eyes from it again. Minute by minute, he grows paler. At last, he makes a movement and whispers,
"Ernst."
I bend to his mouth.
"Take out my things," he says.
"There's plenty of time for that, Heinrich."
"No, no, get on."
I spread them out before him. The pocketbook of frayed calico, the knife, the watch, the money. One gets to know these things. Loose in the pocketbook is the picture of his wife.
"Show me,"
he says. I take it out and hold it so that he can see it. A clear, brownish face. He considers it. After a while, he whispers,
"So, that is finished,"
and his lips quiver. At last, he turns away his head.
"Take it,"
he says. I do not understand what he means, but I do not want to ask him more questions, so I thrust it into my pocket.
"Take those to her."
He looks at the other things. I nod.
"And tell her."
He looks at me with a strange, great gaze, murmurs, shakes his head, and groans. I try desperately to understand, but now he only gurgles. He twitches, breathes more heavily, more slowly, with pauses, slackening. Then once more, very deep and sighing, and suddenly has eyes as if he had been blinded and is dead. Next morning, we are in the front trenches for the last time. Hardly a shot is fired. The war is ended. In an hour, we must pull out. We need never come back here again. When we go forever. What there is to be destroyed, we destroy. It is little enough, only a couple of dugouts. Then comes the order to retreat. It is a strange moment. We stand side by side and look toward the front. Light trailers of mist lie over the ground. The lines of shell holes and trenches are clearly visible. They are indeed only the last line. They belong really to the reserve position. Still, they are well within range of the guns. How often we have gone in through those saps. How often and how few we have come back through them. Gray stretches the monotonous landscape before us. In the distance, what is left of a copse, a few stumps, the ruins of a village. In the midst of it, one solitary high wall that has withstood it all.
Yes, says Bethke meditatively. It's 4 years. 4 years we've been sitting there.
Yes, damn it all, nods Kozola. And now it just fizzles out.
Well, well, Vili leans back against the parapet. Funny, eh? We stand and gaze. The farmhouse, the remnants of the wood, the heights, the trenches on the skyline yonder. It had been a terrible world, and life a burden. Now it is over, and will stay behind here. When we set out, it will drop behind us, step by step, and in an hour be gone as if it had never been. Who can realize it? There we stand and should laugh and shout for joy, and yet we have now a sick feeling in the pit of our stomachs, as one who swallows a throat swab and would vomit. None knows what to say. Ludwig Breyer leans wearily against the side of the trench and raises his hand as if there were some man yonder to whom he would wave. Hale appears.
Can't bear to leave it, eh? Well, now for the dregs.
Lederhose looks at him in astonishment.
Now for peace, you mean?
Yes, that's it.
The dregs, says Hale, and goes off, looking as if his mother had just died.
He hasn't got his poor La Merite. That's what's biting him, explains Lederhose.
Shut your mug, says Albert.
Well, let's go,
urges Bethke, but still stands on.
A lot of us lying there, says Ludwig.
Yes, Brandt, Müller, Kat, Haya, Boehmer, Bertink, Sandkuhl, Minders, the two Terbruggen, Hugo, Bernhardt.
For Christ's sake, stop, man.
They are many indeed that lie there, though until now we have not thought of it so. Hitherto we have just all remained there together, they in the graves, we in the trenches, divided only by a few handfuls of earth. They were but a little before us. Daily we became less and they more, and often we have not known whether we already belonged to them or not. And sometimes, too, the shells would bring them back among us again. Crumbling bones tossed up, scraps of uniform, wet, decayed heads, already earthy, to the noise of the drum fire issuing once more from their buried dugouts and returning to the battle. It did not seem to us terrible. We were too near to them. But now we are going back into life, and they must stay there. Ludwig, whose cousin was killed in this sector, blows his nose through his fingers and turns about. Slowly we follow. But we halt yet a few times and look about us, and again we stand still. And suddenly we know that all that yonder, that hell of terrors, that desolate corner of shell-hole land has usurped our hearts. Yes, damn it, that it should sound such slush. It seems almost as if it had become endeared to us, a dreadful homeland, full of torment, and we simply belonged in it. We shake our heads, but whether it be the lost years that remain there, or the comrades who lie there, or all the misery that this earth covers. There is a grief in our bones, enough to make us howl aloud. And so we march out.